Ready to go? Welcome, everybody, to the February 3rd meeting of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. We've got a number of bills we're going to take up today. We'll start out with Senate Bill 1583. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1583, we heard this, it seems like a long time ago, but it was just 2 days ago. This is a measure that authorized the Office of Small Business Assistance as part of its duties to coordinate with and provide assistance to county and municipal agencies and authorities. It authorized the office to offer small businesses to refer them to the appropriate resources and answer questions posed by the small business. It has an emergency clause that would take effect upon passage. When we met on Monday, we had before us the -1 amendment, which fixes Scrivener's error on page 1, line 12, and we also had the -2 amendment. Actually, we now have the -2 amendment, which was briefly mentioned. So those are the two amendments we have before us. They're both available on OLIS, and that's where we're at, Mr. Chair.
Alrighty, and I think we had information meetings the other day, but we do need to have a public hearing, so we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1583, and as soon as I get the list, we'll call somebody up. Are you leading off, Robert? No? All right. Yes, you are. You're first.
are we going to move this one?
You may. Since it's the governor, ex-secretary of state, and the current secretary of state's bill, we'll let you guys go first.
Oh, thank you. Chair Bayo, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ivo Trimmer. I'm the legislative director for Governor Brown's office. I'm here today to follow up on SB 1583, which you heard about on Monday. You heard from my colleague, Gina Seidlick, who is out sick today, so that's why get me. I want to remind you the bill does two very basic things. One, it expands the ability of the Office of Small Business Assistance to help small businesses navigate any level of government, state or local, already on the state side. And number two, it ensures that the office is clearly tasked with being able to truly function as an ombudsman, if you will, and as a facilitator and problem solver for small businesses statewide. The small business advocate is known for solving problems before they even arise and helping policymakers be informed about problems that small businesses run into when dealing with government entities. I'm here in support of the -1 amendment, which basically fixes a small typo or changes the word "of" with the word "or." Happy to answer any questions.
Robert?
I'm Robert Taylor, Deputy Secretary of State, here on behalf of Gene Atkins. We support the bill. One of the frustrations, I think, that citizens have, small businesses have, when they interact with government is when the person, when the government employee on the other end of the line says, "I'm sorry, I can't help you, that's not in my jurisdiction." And that is what the existing law puts our small business advocate in, that type of a situation, where by the letter of the existing law, we can help small businesses navigate through regulatory issues with state agencies, but we don't have that same authority with regard to municipalities. And as Senator Thompson brought up in our last hearing, we don't like being in that position. So if somebody has a problem with the local government, we will help them. We will do that. But it would be nice if the authority in the statute matched that, so that we had clear authority to be helpful for people, so we're not put in that position that Senator Thompson highlighted, which is, do we really have to turn people away? And nobody wants us to turn them away. We don't want to turn those people away. So the bill as drafted with the -1 would allow us to do what I think people expect us to do, which is help them navigate regulatory issues at all levels of government.
We talked about this the other day, but let's just be real clear on the record on this one. This is an ombuds role, which is a role to advocate. It doesn't give the ombudsman, the state ombudsman, any authority over local governments in any way.
No.
So,
no.
I mean, it's if a local government has an issue with a business and they want to be recalcitrant, they certainly still can do that.
Yeah.
This just gives Ruth the ability to give them a call. Right. Okay. Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wondered, how do people know about this office? Is there any outreach? Is there any advertising? How do people learn about this office?
Chair Beyer, Senator Riley, Robert Taylor for the record. Our small business advocate, Ruth Miles, does a good job of doing outreach in the community. She does town halls around the state, meets with chambers of commerce, for example, to get the word out. And she's going to be releasing her second annual report later this session, and you'll see that her caseload has grown, and the types of cases she's getting are reflecting a lot of that outreach. So she does do that. It is a small office. It's just a two-person shop right now. So, but we do try to get the word out to people. And legislators certainly are welcome to get that word out, too. And, in fact, Ruth has gotten a lot of her referrals from legislative offices, and that's something we're very happy to do.
Okay. Any other? No. Oh, Senator Gerard.
Thank you, Chair. The question I have is with the dash ones. You're changing an of to an or, and my reading of that, it doesn't read correctly. So,
Mr. Chair, if you may, we have an amendment. The dash one amendment fixes that. That's a Scribner's error. So with the dash one amendment to the original bill, that would be fixed, I believe.
Well, here's the original. Well, no, hold on.
Looking at the amendment.
Yeah, well, here's the amendment right there. Okay, I'm all right.
You okay?
Yeah.
Okey-do. Anything else? Thank you, gentlemen. And let's see here. LOC and AOC, Wendy Johnson and Mary Cern.
What amendment are we talking about?
So it's the dash.
It's the dash two?
The dash one.
Welcome, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. The League supports this bill with the dash two amendments that you have before you. The dash one's just changed the word or so that it read grammatically correct. The dash two amendments would change the definition. Right now, the bill uses a new term of government agency and includes both state government and local government in that term and then uses it throughout the bill. In the dash two amendments, it would keep what's in existing law of state agency and then define local government. And local government would include cities, counties, and special districts. We have a lot of economic development districts and such, too, that it would make sense to include them. So we're recommending a different definition for policy reasons, but we're also, more importantly, recommending a change throughout the bill so that local government is treated like it should be as a separate government that can't be told by the state what to do in this regard. It really is a cooperation, and so we support the concept of an ombudsman to help with small businesses, in whether it be in state government or local government. So we're keeping basically the same concept of the facilitating, enforcing, and regulation portion so that the office could work with small government or local governments and small businesses, but it's taking it out of that last section of the bill, section three, where there's a complaint process and a report process. And right now, state agencies have to respond to the report, the preliminary report, within 15 days. And it would just take us out of that portion so that we're not part of a complaint, an investigation, and report. But it would keep us in the section two part, which is the part where it gives authority to the office to work with both local government and state governments with its interactions with small businesses. We feel like that meets our principles at the League of Home Rule, and it still accomplishes the very goal of cooperation with small businesses in urban and rural Oregon. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. There's also no fiscal with the dash two amendments. We would have an indeterminate fiscal with the original bill because it does direct local governments to do things that they don't presently do.
Go ahead.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Mary Stern. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, representing all 36 of Oregon's counties. And just like my colleague here, Wendy Johnson, we also support the dash two amendments only. We would support the bill only with those amendments. Pardon me. counties know that small business are the backbone of economic development and economic drivers throughout the state. And counties support business, and we have a long history of doing that. I'm not sure what problem this bill is trying to fix. Our commissioners and judges are not aware of any issues that they've had supporting small business that if they can't fix, they'll work with the state to try and fix those issues. So we're not sure of what issue this is, what problem this is trying to solve. And as you mentioned, Chair Beyer, that this just gives the small business office the ability to give a call to local jurisdictions. Well, they already have that ability to do that, and they do it, and that telephone call works both ways. So we just want to put on record that AOC supports this bill with the Dash 2 amendments only. And I'm happy to answer any questions as well.
I'm in search of a problem here, but I don't see one. Okay. Questions?
And the question I have is with the state. Can we get the governor's
staff? We sure can get him back. If you don't have questions of these two ladies,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Trummer.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Thank you. The question I have is, why don't you like the Dash 2s versus the Dash 1s don't do anything, but why don't you like the Dash 2s?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I appreciate the question. I'm actually very familiar with the Dash 2s, and we reached out to the League, and I appreciate that we had a long discussion about this. I think the basic concern I would have is that it would create different processes and a little confusion on how to approach local government from the Office of Small Business Assistance. That's really what it comes down to. I understand and appreciate that, you know, even the perception of accountability might be discomforting to folks, but that's really what this is. This creates not a direct order that the state has ability to interfere in how local government treats small businesses. It's just an avenue to help small businesses navigate.
Go ahead.
Would you oppose the bill with the Dash 2s? I know you don't want them. I'm just trying to...
We strongly feel, and the governor strongly feels, that the bill is written with the Dash 1 is the bill that we would like to see, because it will give the office also more ability to help small businesses statewide.
That wasn't his question.
That wasn't my question.
But I think you got an answer. I think there's an answer there, but maybe you want to be more direct. You want to ask it again?
Yeah. Would you oppose it if we had the Dash 2 amendments?
We wouldn't necessarily oppose the bill if it reaches the governor's desk, if that's the question you have, but we would strongly argue throughout that it waters down the bill and the intent. Obviously, it is your privilege to decide which bill you want to see go forward.
Well, my point is, you got both the counties and the cities, which are two fairly significant entities, don't like the language and where you're going with it. So it would... I was okay with the original bill. I thought it was a pretty good bill, but it seems to me like there would be a compromise to be reached somewhere, and I don't understand what they're asking for. I can't read where that is that
big
detrimental. But maybe I'm just not reading it right, but if you want to point out in the actual amendment the language that you're most concerned about, I would be interested in that.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'd be happy to go through that line by line, but the basic fear we would have, or the governor has expressed, is that it would create two different processes and kind of create, imagine a company that would come in then have an issue with a state agency and a local government, and we would have to treat it somewhat differently. We would, the bill as written would sort of take care of that problem, would take care of that problem.
So it just changes the definition. Wherever the word government appears, it appears that it just adds cities or counties.
It lets them not do the report.
Chair Beyer, member of the committees, Robert Taylor for the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State, Atkins, is neutral on the Dash 2s. The way we understand that amendment is it would give us, as Senator Riley talked about, it would give us the same ability to work collaboratively with the local governments that we have right now with state agencies. So it gives us that ability. What it does is it takes the municipalities out of Section 3, which is the complaint process and the report process. And so what the governor's office is talking about is this concern that if a small business has an issue with environmental regulatory authorities, let's say, at the state and local level.
It just adds up.
That we'd be in a position to tell the small business, well, we can handle a complaint and do a report for the state agency, but your problem that you've got and the complaint you want to file with the local regulatory agency, we can't do that. And it kind of gets us back to the position we were in before of telling that small business, well, if you got a problem with the state, we can help you. If you want to file a complaint about the local, we can't help you. But ultimately, it gets us very, very far down the road, and that's why we're neutral. But we just want to be clear, we would have that type of situation again.
Well, I don't really think it does that, but I don't really think the dash twos do anything. Senator, you had a question.
I would just, you know, I'm really working hard on my new attitude this session. And when we have the governors, we all have cities and counties in our districts, and we have a governor that's trying to get a bill passed. And I'd just like to see them get to work this out. I don't know if it needs a little bit more work. Maybe you can't get past this. But I'd like to vote for something that everybody agrees on, if that's possible.
Senator Riley?
Yeah. First of all, my understanding is that this is the Secretary of State's office that does it, and they're neutral on this. What I see and how I understand the cities and counties' problem, and I actually agree with them, that they are being put in a position of explaining to the state what their position is and defending their position. And I think that maybe is their problem, and I think that that's, I agree with them that they should not be put in that position in this instance.
I didn't really think that there, I'm just,
could we get
we're
the
discussing
cities and
that
the counties back and
there
see
was
if that's
defense.
What they say?
I thought there was an explain, huh? But I suspect that I may have a, we may have a constitutional issue here, so we may want to put this one over. And
I don't, so
what?
I could vote either way.
Yeah.
I just, it bothers me, though, with what Senator Riley said, or which Senator Thompson, you have three major entities here, and it seems like it's a bit of a turf battle between the three, and two of them are here saying they want an amendment to it. I just say give them the amendment and be done with it.
I think this is almost back to the old grade school thing of you're not the boss of me. And I think what the issue here is that I believe the bill that the governor, then Secretary of State, originally introduced was to not say that, but to say the ombudsman role, which is, if you understand an ombudsman role, is just to try to mediate and resolve. And it seems reasonable to me that in doing that, you would want to set an expectation that all parties would confer and report doing that. Otherwise, you can't get there. You want to send a message to local governments that you need to participate. I think that's what you're trying to do. It seems like this language doesn't quite get there. So how about if we set it over till Monday? With the cooperation here, I think we want to move this bill, but I think you have a little bit of a language issue here that may not allow it to be moved today.
Sure, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. Thank you.
I think that's a good idea.
But I want to be clear, at least from my perspective, I think local governments want to be in a cooperative mood here. And, you know, you don't want to set yourself in excluding. It would be real clear there's no way they can tell you what to do with your local issues. Okay? Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you,
is there anybody
Chair.
Else who felt the need to testify on this bill today? All right, so one down. We're not moving that one. We will close the public hearing, and we will set that over until our next meeting.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Why don't we do this with Senator Crowe's comments?
All righty. So now we're going to open a public hearing on Senate. Can I open them both at the same time? I got it. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1589. And Patrick, and I think I have Senator Rosenbaum here.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill modifies the definition of qualified business that it's eligible for loans or credit guarantees from the Credit Enhancement Fund to include existing or proposed businesses located in Oregon that will produce substantial benefits for the state. Declares emergency as it effective upon passage. Since we met last time, we have received a statement of minimal fiscal impact and minimal revenue impact. This bill came to us with a subsequent referral on the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, but that referral has since been rescinded by the Senate President. So should the committee take action on this bill today, the action would be to rescind the referral to Ways and Means and send it to the floor, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Rosenbaum, welcome.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. And it's great to see you again. You heard from the chief sponsors of the bill on Monday, myself and Senators Revlin and Manas Anderson, about the Credit Enhancement Fund, which is a small business loan program that has done a lot of good for a lot of small businesses around the state. And by changing the criteria, as this bill does, will make a lot of counties that are currently falling off the list for eligibility again eligible. There's approximately $30 million of additional capacity to loan money to these small businesses for the purposes of expanding or retaining employees or expanding their operations, and that's the simple thing that this bill does. I brought with me today John Saris, who is with Business Oregon, who is the person who is the technical expert on the bill. There as well are a couple of lenders in the audience who administer the loans. They're signed up to testify too, one from a community bank and one from a credit union, and they can tell you a little more specifically about how it works out in the real world. But I think some questions arose at your last hearing, and John Saris is in the best position to answer those. So that's why he's here with me today.
Great. Welcome.
Thank you. Senator Beyer, co-chair Girard, for the record, my name is John Saris, Business Services Manager at the Oregon Business Development Department. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. As Senator Rosenbaum mentioned, just wanted to address a couple of the concerns that were raised by the committee as it relates to this legislation. And those really specifically were, how are we going to ensure that small businesses located in rural Oregon are going to continue to have access to this program? And really, the question about substantial benefit and why that provision for eligibility is included in the draft language. And so basically, just to address those really briefly, one thing that we went back and did after the hearing was to take a look at the data on the program. And we took a look from 2012 through the end of 2015. And the reason we looked at that period of time was because the eligibility criteria for the program really matches what the criteria would be after the adoption of this bill if it does move forward. What the data points to is that during the course of the last 3 years, about 95% of the transactions that were enrolled in this program occurred really outside of the Portland metro market. And that really was from Gresham over to Beaverton Hillsboro and then south to about Wilsonville. The real key for this program as to why that occurs is the nature of the relationships that the staff have with the lenders. This is a small bank type of a program. A lot of the large national banks are SBA lenders. They have processes and government relations centers that help facilitate and monitor those loans. Smaller community banks and credit unions typically don't have the resources necessary to basically maintain the compliance requirements, and this program really matches how they manage their loan portfolio. So we will continue to work with our local banks and our community banks to help ensure small businesses across the state have access. The other question was regarding substantial benefit, and really the intent here is to make sure that a project that is enrolled to this program does have some type of community, local, or state benefit associated with it. And economic development, that can be a number of different things. Could be job creation retention, could be basically expansion into new markets, increased sales, and things like that, that help support business growth. So ultimately what it does do is allow us to be looking for public benefit on the transactions, and if there isn't a benefit, then it wouldn't be eligible in the program. And some things that don't have necessarily a strong public benefit might be a debt refinance or I wrote down a couple of things here, debt refinance, stock acquisition, partial company buyout, things of that nature. So that was the intent. And one other thing I'd like to point out, too, right now is that this is a small business program. The average firm size that's enrolled in this particular loan program is about 15 employees at the time. So it does focus and target small business. And the other piece, too, is that no money from this particular program gets directly into the hands of a small business. This is an insurance program that insures individual loans and transactions made by a lender. It's the lender's private capital that's being deployed to the business community. They're ultimately the ones underwriting it and making the determinations if this is a business worth lending to. So with that, I will cease and desist and answer questions that we do have. We have Gary O'Connell with Summit Bank. We're working out of the Central Oregon community, and we have Adriana Dodge with Northwest Community Credit Union out of the Eugene market area.
Questions of okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So then, Mr. O'Connell and let's see, Ms. Dodge. Aha. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm a banker, so I'll cease from using the term cease and desist. In our world, that's a different meeting, but thank you. I want to keep this brief with respect to time and put it in context. It was a privilege to come here from Ben.
Can we have you put your name on the record, please?
Thank you. My name is Gary O'Connell with Summit Bank. So to give you some context of what you're already aware of, the Central Oregon region has been a very volatile region. I've been there 16 years. We've seen an upcycle, but we have also seen a very severe down cycle. So the talk now is at a chamber event last night. Business owners are talking about adding sustainable jobs. And the jobs we lost, we're trying to replace with a different kind of job now. So that could be traded sector, scalable businesses, fabricators, manufacturers. The tech space is starting to grow there as well. There's a lot of community involvement. So as bankers, we have tools in our toolbox, probably the most important tool. As a business bank, we're pushing capital out to small and middle-sized businesses in Central Oregon, and that's our partnership with Business Oregon. So there's other tools as well, but that's a key tool in the toolbox to push out capital that otherwise would not go out. Now, some of these businesses are very sound businesses, but they don't maybe fit a traditional box as far as typical business lending doctrine. A couple examples, I can give you faces and names, but one was at my desk yesterday. Traded sector companies, a tech company, food and beverage manufacturing is growing there. And they're having all sorts of conversations about partnerships to get, and not just the lending, but, enterprise zone tax benefits and reasons to stay in Oregon when other states are competing with them. The capital is a big part of that. Food and beverage manufacturer is a perfect fit, looking to add about 20 jobs, good-paying jobs, and they're being recruited out of state. Food and beverage manufacturers can co-pack elsewhere. They can have multiple locations. So when we give thought to who's hiring, what are they using the funds for, maybe it's capital expenditures and people to run the equipment and expanding locations, adding a second location. The credit enhancement fund tools are just, they've been extremely pivotal in helping to push out the capital. We've worked on projects the last 5 years, manufacturers in Primeville, a project in Redmond and in Bend, and it's really satisfying to be able to have this private-public partnership to be able to continue doing that. Now, I know there's language in 1589 discussing what's distressed and what's not distressed and what's traded sector, but I can tell you we've talked to folks who fall through the cracks. I know a lot of business owners who are distressed, even though maybe Deschutes won't be a distressed area anymore. We still have distressed businesses, but they're showing signs of recovery. Secondly, they may not be traded sector now, but they're trying to be, and they're trying to get there. So those are specifically targets of who we're trying to deploy capital out to. And so it's my dear hope that we can have the conversation and keep the eligibility so that we can do good things in Central Oregon.
Thank you.
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Adriana Dodge. I'm here today in my capacity as portfolio administrator with Northwest Community Credit Union to offer public testimony for Senate Bill 1589. Since 2011, Business Oregon's Credit Enhancement Fund programs have made it possible for my customers in Lane and Douglas counties to obtain lines of credit that support their working capital needs and also term loans to finance their equipment necessary to expand their production or product lines, as well as real estate to relocate or expand their business footprint. Those loans would not have been possible for these customers if not for the Credit Enhancement Fund programs. The folks that need these programs have tried to get conventional loans and lines but fell short for various reasons that may include the businesses being required to use up all of their cash reserves or because the need for funds is based on projections. The proposed change in eligibility criteria would be beneficial for the lenders who are marketing these programs. Historically, deals have been held up while the lender and Business Oregon determine if the customer qualifies based on trade sector and location. This change in eligibility would put the focus back on the customer's creditworthiness and not so much on their address. This simplification would allow us to focus on the most important matter at hand, getting capital into the hands of our local businesses. If the proposed change in distress status comes to fruition for Lane or Douglas County, it would have a negative impact on the small businesses for those counties. I agree that Portland, Eugene, and Medford and the surrounding areas are creating more revenue and appear to be stable compared to recessionary times. But what is not being considered is the disparity between the revenue-producing potential of small businesses compared to their larger industry counterparts. The Credit Enhancement Fund program keeps these small businesses alive by allowing them to grow or make themselves marketable in their industries. We need these small businesses. They are our manufacturers, retailers, distributors, and entrepreneurs who are creating revenue that will stay in our state. The mom-and-pop shops don't have the deep pockets that the bigger organizations have, and the Credit Enhancement Fund is the catalyst helping these small businesses survive.
Thank you. Any questions, committee? I see none. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anybody else who wishes to comment on Senate Bill 1589? We have all papers in
here, Mr. Chair, yes.
So we will close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 1589. And the chair would move Senate Bill 1589 to the floor with a due pass and recommend that we rescind the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. A discussion on the motion. Senator Jerome.
Yeah, I'm going to be a no. And the reason I'm a no is we have a lot of distressed areas in this state. This money is set aside for distressed areas. This makes Multnomah County, Lane County, and a couple other counties count as distressed counties. I'm sorry, this money needs to go to rural Oregon, where really we are distressed. And this just really bothers me. I just see it as a big money grab.
Any other comments? I would just comment that my good vice chair, that I don't think that indeed the case. There's sufficient money that's there that no one is losing out. No. Anyway, so any other things? All right, so no other no's. So please record Senator Girard as a no on the bill, and the bill passes 4-1. We are closed on that one, and I'm
going to Senator Rosenbaum to carry this bill.
Oh, yes, Senator Rosenbaum, would you please carry?
Yeah.
All right, and I think we will take up 1572 next, and I'm going to go down there. Pass this over to you. Pass this 1572.
Thanks so much. Brings back something, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, would you like me to give a brief summary of 1572 for you, Mr. Chair?
I should say no, but I'll say yes.
Oh, thank you. Very persuasive, I see. Senate Bill 1572 directs the PUC to establish a program for procurement of electricity from community solar projects. It establishes guidelines for the program implementation and qualifications for community solar projects. It requires the Commission to report on implementation of the program to the interim legislative committees related to business and energy on or before January 1st, 2019. There is also a -3 amendment, which I believe our witness at the witness table is going to address, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, Lee Beyer, State Senator from District 6, which is Central Linn and Lane Counties. We've talked about this before. As you'll recall, during the last session, we talked a lot about this in the last session. We ended up passing a bill directing the PUC to review this and come back with us for recommendations on, if we were to pass this policy, how to do it. They did that. They made a report in November, and the bill before you is based largely on that, although we didn't necessarily take all of their recommendations. Been working on this a long time. So what is community solar? Let's start out with there very clearly. The best description I have of that is think about it as a condominium, in that a number of people go together and buy a solar array, each owning a small piece of it that's theirs and attributed to their bill, and the overall operation of it they own in common. This bill is trying to promote that, and why would we do that? There are lots of people who would like to do that who, frankly, don't have the roof space or the right direction on the roof to get involved in it. Are there a tenant somewhere else and can't put it on that building? Could be in a condominium, actually, that won't allow it. So this allows it to do that. So that's a benefit to individuals who wish to do it this way, wish to be involved with solar renewable power. The other piece of it is when you do it in a larger project, it's cheaper. So they can do it. It makes it more available to more people, and it's also dispatchable. What that term means is the power company can have control over it, so it works into the system better. It's in front of the meter, so to speak, rather than behind the meter where the power company can't actually see it. They can't make it work and fit it into the system. So that's the advantages of doing it this way. What the bill does is treats it, is it going to have an impact on other rate players? It may or it may not. It actually may have a benefit to them, depending on how the PUC sets it up. It essentially, what the bill says is that the PUC will set a rate for the energy that they're going to pay the person for, or actually more commonly trade it back and forth, at a rate that reflects the actual cost of the energy. My personal view is that energy is likely to be more expensive than what you can buy at retail from Portland General or Pacific Core, but that's a choice that people will make. They can offset that. And if you're doing it on your roof, we call it net metering. This is more of a virtual way of doing that, where the utility will look at the bill and say, how much did we see go to their house and how much did you generate? And you get that under federal law. They can't get compensated for more energy than they actually use. So if there's excess, it goes into the system to benefit other ratepayers, low income, that sort of thing. So that's the structure that's there. We've intentionally drafted the bill very wide in terms of allowing lots of discretion to potential developers to put it together. It does require power companies, as they're required for an individual house now, to take the power. Have to sign into a long-term contract, 20-year contract on that. If you're a subscriber, meaning you may not be an owner, you may be the way I've described it is a leasee on it. You have to sign up for at least 10 years on doing that. So there's some issues that will have to be worked out administratively. They're not, in my opinion, a matter for statutory law. We've got to get some flexibility to the developers, the power companies, and the PUC to try and make it work that way. This is not a new concept. If you look across the country, Oregon is not a leader in this, but many other states are doing it already. The proliferation of them in other states tends to be from consumer-owned utility companies that are trying to do it. You actually have a couple in Oregon, that Central Oregon, down in my area, PUDs that are trying to do this now. Not an easy thing to do. I think there's a vision that if we open the doors that there's just going to be all these developments happening. I don't think that is likely to be the case. I think it'll be a very go slow process because you got a couple things in play. One, it's hard to finance these on one hand, so it's going to take some work to line up enough subscribers to make it work. And on the other hand, it's more expensive. I think it'll be more expensive energy, but that's a choice that people will make. So this is, as we like to say, this is permissive legislation. It allows people to do things. It doesn't require it. It puts the responsibility for paying for it on those people who are doing it, not on everybody else. So I think it's a good approach. People want to do it. It's a good thing. In general, to the extent we can get that there, there's benefits to the utilities to have that out there, and I suspect you'll hear that from them. They may not always be the way they would like it, but, you know, it's a place to start. So, Mr. Chair, that's a general testimony. The bill's pretty short and clear.
Senator Thompson.
Senator Beyer, you mentioned that there might be a cost to other ratepayers. Might not. There might or might not be. How could you assure that there won't be? Could you put any wording in there that's there? Or why can't you? I know you know what you're talking about, but so why can't you say there won't be or will be? What are the factors that go into that?
I could tell you that the sun will shine 365 days a year, but I can't assure you of that.
Well, that's true.
Here's the things that I think will be there. There is some cost to the utility in setting up an administrative structure to do this. I personally don't think it's a lot. If I were doing it, and they will probably, I've heard them say many times over in my 10 years at the PUC about any change to the system requires all this, but you could do this in terms of what we call truing up, similar to their level pay programs now, where they know what they're selling you and they know what's coming in, and if there's a difference, you true it up at some point. I don't think that's real expensive, but there could be a limited cost there. I would say it was de minimis to do that. And kind of, I can't tell you exactly, because it kind of depends on what the PU sets as a rate that's reflective of the actual cost. The intent is that the projects will carry their own cost.
Okay.
But I don't know what that is. Okay. And they've been working on that.
You mentioned, too, that, okay, you might have five people that want to do this as a community thing. Could it be that small? Can it be... Is it going to have to be 20 or 50?
Again, that's going to depend on the developer who's putting the project together. My guess is, from having looked at these in other places, you're probably talking at projects that are in the megawatt range.
Okay.
So you know maybe 10 megawatts, maybe smaller than that. So you're probably talking at least tens, and maybe 50 to 100 people.
Okay, and then we'll follow up on that. So you said some of those people, let's say they put them on the roofs, but some people want to be in this, but they don't have the right pitch or they don't have the right direction of a roof.
Correct.
But they would pay to get into this?
Yes.
And so how would that work?
Well, it'd be like... I'm trying to do it with an analogy.
So they community-wise
like
reduce everybody's...
It would be like buying an apartment in a condominium building. You're buying, in essence, think of you have a project that says, say, has 100 panels,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and you decide that you're going to buy 3 panels.
Okay.
So you get the electricity that's generated, proportionally of those 3. It wouldn't necessarily be
right.
those 3, but you'll get 3 panels worth of electricity out of the project.
Okay.
Whatever that is.
I think I've grilled him enough.
You done?
Yeah.
Senator Riley.
So thank you. We're talking about the number of people in a project, but really it's the amount of money. And so if we needed 10 people's worth of money, 3 people could put up more money and do the project.
That's true.
Any other questions? I actually have one question. You have a very nice relating clause.
Yeah, I know.
and some of us on this committee are really concerned because hydrogen technology and hydro generated from irrigation districts are not considered renewable on the renewable portfolio standard. Would you be opposed to adding that to this bill?
Well, Mr. Chair. I think there's already provisions provided in statute for small hydro already. So you already could do that.
Hydrogen technology would be anything but small. That would be from our major hydro producers. That would be major.
No, there's provisions for small, under the original RPS bill, there's provisions for small hydro projects. Some of the irrigation districts have looked at that in common.
I think you misunderstood. There's two parts. One would be hydro technology, which would be probably done at Bonneville or the big dams, and then hydro from irrigation districts. So
you lost me.
Okay, hydrogen technology basically is a technology that during non-peak hours, you take the water molecule with the excess power that you have, you cleave it, you mix it with the hydrogen with nitrogen, and you form ammonia. And then during peak hours, you burn the ammonia back. And the byproduct is water. It's a continuous loop. That technology is available, but it's not under the renewable portfolio standard. That would be done probably by the major electric companies, by the major dams like Bonneville, et cetera. We have an abundance of hydro in this state, and hydro technology is as clean as it gets. Wow. So to make the most use out of that hydro, it seems logical, and that's why we would like to see hydrogen technology as part of the renewable portfolio standard.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that that's already possible under the existing renewable portfolio standard. There's a lot of those. In fact, if you remember a couple sessions ago, we extended it to cover geothermal. I think you can do that now. The difference here is this is intended to allow, you know, pretty much small users, you know, households to be able to do it. The kinds of projects you're describing, which I'm very supportive of, you wouldn't see that happen. They would be developed by a large developer. They could do it now under what's called a qualifying facility under federal and state law. So I'm not disagreeing with you. I just don't think it fits the concept of a community project.
It doesn't. I'm not saying it does. I'm saying relating clause.
You want to do the relating to?
To put this in. We don't have too many opportunities.
I'm relating clause say.
relating to utility regulation, Mr.
Yeah, I was afraid of that.
So that's. Yeah, we have no vehicle to do that. And this state is blessed with a tremendous amount of hydro. And it's just cheaper to use hydro than it is most everything that you are, solar to windmills to whatever.
I would be happy to have you have a conversation with one of my local utilities, EWEB, that's dealing with relicensing a plant right now, dams up on the McKenzie. Mm-hmm. Not easy. I don't disagree with you. I don't disagree with you. I do think the thing, what you're interested in, is available under current law.
Can we? You don't what need I'm asking for is, can that. We amend this bill to put that into the bill?
Well, I guess you could, but I don't think you need to because I think you can do that under existing law already.
Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Okay, we have, we'll bring a panel of four up. James Valdez, Charlie Coggleshell, Ricky Sequin. Sequin. Keith, boy, my handwriting's really good here.
You can get them all together.
Queenie.
Here, we'll got extra chairs now. Sorry, here, we'll move down a little.
Musical chair.
Music hasn't stopped yet.
Well, just as soon as you find a seat, welcome. Welcome.
Thank you, Senator Beyer and members of the committee. For the record, my name is James Valdez with Northwest Sustainable Energy for Economic Development. We're a nonprofit dedicated to energy education, technical assistance, and creating opportunities for customers to own and participate in locally based renewables. Mm-hmm. And we thank you, Senator Beyer, for bringing forward this bill. And I know that we've been working on this concept for a number of years and are very happy to support Senate Bill 1572. We think it's an important piece of our new energy infrastructure that allows access and new choices for those who haven't previously been able to access the benefits of solar energy. And so we're very excited for the effective deployment of these programs. We do think that can be large and successful. We do have a few concerns with the Dash 3 amendment. The original bill, as introduced, has some provisions for low-income participation and some targets for the Public Utility Commission to explore ways to bring the benefits of solar energy to lower-income customers. And we do feel that a low-income inclusionary target is an important tool to ensure equitable access to these programs, and that it really does provide the opportunity for that long-term bill reduction based on a resource and doesn't have to be on their property. That's very similar to bill assistance. And we think that there's a flexible mechanism in the existing bill language for the Public Utility Commission to adjust that as necessary or to direct projects to meet that. So we support the existing inclusion of that that language and not the deletion of lines, I guess, 17 through 27 on page 3 that are suggested in the Dash 3 amendment. So without getting into too many details. And just generally, we also think that it's important that incentives that are available for existing on-site solar customers or renewable energy generation projects are also made available to these community solar projects in order to reduce the cost and make them more more effective and successful. And so I'm thinking specifically of energy trust incentives. The bill doesn't address that one way or the other, but we just want to state on the record that we think it's important that there be equitable access to those existing programs. And that also that there's that the renewable energy certificates are treated in a way that's consistent with existing state policy and maintains the integrity of both the voluntary green power programs as well as all the renewable portfolio compliance mechanisms that exist. And so those are, I'd say, some minor concerns. We are very happy to support this bill, and we look forward to having an effective and successful community solar program in the future. So thank you.
Who's next?
I'll go next. Thank you, Senator Beyer, members of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. My name is Charlie Coggeshall, and today I'm representing the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. I'm on the board of directors there, but I'm also a policy analyst for Clean Energy Collective, which is the nation's largest developer and solutions provider for community solar projects. And I live in Portland, Oregon. Briefly, OSEA is a trade association. It was founded in 1981 to promote clean, renewable solar technologies. And one of our goals is to present a unified and respected voice of the solar industry on policy and regulatory issues to promote the solar energy economy in Oregon. We were engaged in the regulatory process that Senator Beyer spoke about briefly, UM 1746, this past fall, and we were encouraged by the resulting PUC recommendations that were made to the legislature. We were even more encouraged by Senator Beyer's leadership and leveraging an expansion of those PUC recommendations in developing this bill. I'm going to reiterate some of the benefits that Senator Beyer has already talked about. Oregon solar industry has a vested interest in allowing for community solar in the state. It represents an opportunity to expand the jobs and capabilities of the state solar industry. It opens up the market to a new channel of customers that may otherwise be unable to access the economic and environmental benefits of clean energy. And honestly, that represents that portion of the population is probably the majority of the population. It also offers the ability to leverage economies of scale to develop systems at lower cost points and potentially in more optimal locations and configurations. Finally, community solar provides customers with more options. This is something that is increasingly of greater demand across the country as distributed energy technologies advance and prices come down. OSEA wants to be able to provide this opportunity to Oregon residents and businesses. We also want to be able to compete for those customers and in turn drive greater efficiencies and cost reductions in the market. To that end, OSEA supports the SB 1572's intent to enable a competitive community solar market that fosters innovation and allows for broad participation among Oregon residents and businesses. And based on my company's experience in this sector, I can directly testify to the importance of a strong, well-designed community solar legislation and believe SB 1572 essentially achieves that goal. We do have some concerns on the latest version that was introduced, 1572-3, regarding REC ownership, which I think could require some clarification. But for the most part, we're supportive of the bill. And we're grateful for Senator Beyer's leadership. We encourage SB 1572 to be implemented in conjunction with existing and future solar and renewable energy programs in the state. And we applaud your introduction into HB 4036 earlier this week and think that would also serve as an excellent channel. Either way, we're looking forward to having a community solar market. Thank you, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Who's next? Ricky?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Ricky Seguin. I work as the director of Environment Oregon. Environment Oregon is a statewide, citizen-based environmental advocacy organization. We represent over 40,000 Oregonians from all corners of the state. And I am here to enthusiastically support Senate Bill 1572-3 with one note of concern in the amendments regarding the ownership of the renewable energy certificates, or the RECs, which I'll get to. Thank you to Senator Beyer for the continued hard work on getting community solar right for the past year and a half, 2 years. We've all been very involved in the regulatory proceedings this summer and the development of the legislation. And this really is an opportunity for Oregonians to get in the game with clean energy. Studies show that 3 out of 4 Oregonians don't have rooftops suitable for solar panels, and study after study shows that people want access to clean energy. Myself as a renter, this is a program that's available to me if this passes. It increases access to solar, which is key for Oregon mitigating its contribution to global warming, which we're seeing the effects of every single day. It's a flexible program, as Senator Beyer mentioned. I think this is very important. We can learn from the first few years of the program. The legislature can make changes. The PUC has the authority to make changes. And projects can vary based on what the market is demanding. And that's very important for a new program. As I mentioned, it has clear oversight and opportunity for involvement from both the legislature and the Public Utility Commission. The Public Utility Commission will certify projects, community solar projects, before they're built. Great to have that level of oversight there as well. And I just wanted to spend a quick second to talk about the provision we have a concern with in the -3 amendment regarding the renewable energy certificates. These RECs are essentially the proof that a megawatt hour of electricity generation comes from a renewable source. And in the legislation, it states that these RECs, or this proof of renewable generation, goes to the owner or subscriber of a community solar project, which we think makes a lot of sense. But then what it goes on to say is that the utility company who is purchasing the power from this community solar project can also count the electricity generation toward their renewable portfolio standard compliance. In our mind, that's essentially double counting the same REC. No two parties should be able to lay claim for the renewable energy benefit of the electricity. So again, we strongly support this bill. We strongly support the work that Senator Beyer has done to create a good, strong community solar program for Oregon, but highly encourage the removal of this Section 9 noted in the -3 amendments relating to the renewable energy certificates. Thanks.
Chairman Beyer and members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. For the record, I'm Keith Cuny. I'm with the Community Action Partnership of Oregon. We represent 17 community action agencies statewide that delivers energy assistance and weatherization programs, both from the state and the federal government. Most low-income people pay up to 15 to 20% of their income towards their energy usage per month. And we feel that community solar could be a really valuable tool in offsetting the high energy burden in these households. And we also feel like community solar can penetrate low-income households who don't have the capital to access renewable energy generation. We see that this bill originally was kind of modeled after the Colorado legislation that was passed a few years ago. And in Colorado, they included a low-income element in their community solar bill, and that hasn't hurt development of community solar projects in that state. And there's been going to be several millions of dollars in credits going to low-income families there to offset their bill, and they can have that long-term subscription and provide that stability in their energy bill month to month. So with that said, we would like to see that included as this bill moves forward. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all I have signed up. Does anybody else wish to testify on this bill? I see the utilities don't want to testify. All right. Well, going once, twice, no one else? Okay, we'll close the public hearing, and we'll open a work session on what?
I would like to get an amendment on this.
You would like to get an amendment on it? Well, we'll see. I thought you were going to do a minority report.
Well, I could do a minority report, but it'd be really nice to put an amendment in there. But hydrogen technology and hydro is renewable.
Well, we can. All right, we will set this one over then till Monday. So we will close the public hearing, and we did that. We'll close the work session, and we will move on then to give the senator his opportunity. All right, so where are we at now?
We're at 1591.
What, should we open them together?
There's nobody signed up 1591, so why don't we just open them together?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate bills together on Senate Bill 1590 and 1591. And Patrick.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I better do a rundown on this, shouldn't I? So Senate Bill 1590... was the bill we heard on Monday. It specifies that an insurer has a duty to defend the insured against a claim. It has fiduciary duty towards the insured if the insurer does defend against the claim. There's transparency pieces, et cetera, in here. Again, I will dispense and let Senator Shields have the floor. Since it's his bill, I will mention Senator Shields' office asked if we would accommodate a person on the phone from Shaver Transportation.
Sure.
So I'm going to make that call right now while they're coming sitting down. Is that okay, Mr. Chair?
Okay. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we'll wait till the owner of Shaver gets on the line so he can hear my testimony, if that's okay.
Okay. Sure. Who's the person?
That's Rob Rich from Shaver Transportation.
Hello.
Hi, is this Rob Rich?
No, I think you dialed the wrong number.
I guess maybe we did.
We'll try again.
Thank you.
It's always good to start off laughing, isn't it?
That's what you call a public misdial. Try that again, Patrick.
All right. Well, let's see what we got.
Do you have the right number?
I hope so. Samantha, if you're listening. Okay.
Let's check. What number do you have?
503-7888.
Hang on.
Hold on.
We'll do it the old-fashioned way.
503-781-7685.
Oh, 7685.
Nobody can call me.
That explains it right there.
Boy, was that last guy surprised. Rob Rich.
Hello, this is Rob.
Good afternoon, Mr. Rich. This is Senator Lee Beyer, and we have you on a speakerphone here in front of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. We're about to discuss Senate Bills 1590 and 1591, and Senator Shields asked that we bring you in. So could I get you
I want to thank whoever is allowing the this kind of interaction over the phone rather than a round-trip drive down there. It's a huge help to be able to number one, share, but number two, to not have to actually make the round trip down there, at least at this time. So I really appreciate that opportunity to open all works to folks.
Having made that trip many times, I understand. Could you put your name on the record, please, sir, so we can get it on the recorder?
You bet. My name is Robert Rich, R-I-C-H. I'm Vice President Marine Services for Shaver, S-H-A-V-E-R, Shaver Transportation Company, tug and barge line here in Portland, Oregon.
Okay. Senator Shields, how do you want to do this?
I'd like to go, and then Emily, and then Mr. Rich could provide his own personal story as well.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate. I appreciate you allowing us to come back for a second time for the formal public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 1590 and 1591. I thought it might be good to remind people how we got here, because this issue can seem complicated, and a lot of people thought it came out of nowhere. But I just wanted to remind the committee that I asked a group of bipartisan senators, including the chair, to come together over the last year in a work group to see if we could find some common ground on the most pressing insurance concerns, focusing on small business. We heard from attorneys representing small business. We heard from the Washington Insurance Commissioner policy staff. We heard from an insurance broker. We heard from a small business construction company owner. And we heard from the Oregon Insurance Commissioner, Laura Colley, as well. The insurance division has reviewed the bill and provided feedback and suggested language, and they are neutral on the bill. Members of the work group were free to share the bill's concepts with the insurance lobby, and some of them did. And one of the things that we found in that work group was that Oregon is really an outlier when it comes to protecting policyholders. And an opponent of the bill who testified Monday conceded as much when I was going through my old files. I pulled out a piece of paper that was from his website. This is Lloyd Bernstein. He said on his website, he wrote, quote, "Oregon is the only remaining state out west that does not have statutory or tort-based extra contractual causes of action against insurers, the only western state that doesn't provide kind of extra protection for policyholders." So why do you think every other western state, many considered to be very pro-business, like Montana, provide extra protections for policyholders, every western state but Oregon? And I think the reason is that insurance is different. It's different from buying widgets. It's different from buying candy in a store. It's different from buying a car or buying trucks for your business, because you are more vulnerable in that position. So once you've been sued, a small business has been sued, it's too late to go out and shop for other people who will cover the claim. You are stuck with who you have. And that's what I think is an important reason why all those other states in the West provide those extra protections, because at that point you can't shop around. I'd also like to address some of the things, concerns that I've heard about this bill. I think you heard some very skilled witnesses testify against the bill, and I think their strategy was to kind of muddy the waters, and I think that was accomplished. But one of the things that I think is a very legitimate concern is whether or not premiums will go up should this bill pass. I know that several of you on the panel have mentioned that concern, and I just wanted to make sure that you all know that the evidence actually shows to the contrary. And there is a report from the Washington Insurance Commissioner in OLIS that confirms that claims and premiums did not go up in the state of Washington when they passed a much more comprehensive bill, the Insurance Fair Conduct Act there, and that is in OLIS. The other thing that I would mention on that is that I was with one of the opponents of the bill in a meeting on Monday in Senator Burdick's office, and he argued, well, the breach of the duty to defend, which is really the heart of this bill, the breach of the duty to defend hardly ever happens. And so since that is, in my view, the most important piece of the bill, if that hardly ever happens, I can't imagine how that's going to affect premiums if it hardly ever happens. But the other part of it is that if you're in that position, it only has to happen once, right? And that's why I think those kinds of extra protections in other states are so important. So, again, the heart of the bill, I think, is the duty to defend. And to kind of remind you all what that is, let's say a small business gets sued. You get sued for somebody slips on the sidewalk out in front of your business. You tender your claim to the insurance company. They really have no incentive in Oregon to fulfill that duty to defend. The only remedy that you have is to sue them to make sure that they do it, and then you as a small business have to shell out $20,000 to $30,000 and to get them to provide the defense that they should have provided in the first place. There's really no incentive there outside of attorney fees. So that's why I think this bill is needed. I'd also like to remind you all that you've already voted to put a hammer in place to incentivize the proper fulfillment of the duty to defend. Every single one of us in this room who are a legislator voted to put a hammer in place to incentivize that. And that was with Senate Bill 814. Now, that Senate Bill 814 from 2013 applied mostly to big businesses in the Portland Harbor, and that was around environmental claims. And in Senate Bill 814, there is treble damages, a more significant approach than what is considered in this bill, and for breaching your duty to defend. So it just seems to me that in closing, if you've already voted to provide these kinds of protections for big business in Portland, mostly around the Portland Harbor, don't you think the small businesses in your district deserve those same kinds of protections? And if pro-business states like Montana have seen fit to provide extra protections on the duty to defend in other areas to small business policyholders, shouldn't Oregon join them? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Who's next?
Emily.
Me. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank you for having me. My name is Emily Miller. I'm a partner and coverage attorney at Parsons, Farnell & Grine. And I'm here to support SB 1590. And I'm here not just to express my support, but the support of other coverage attorneys in Oregon that are working on the front lines of coverage disputes. That includes Michael Farnell and Stephen Powers of my firm, Jim McDermott, Kevin Mapes, Dwayne Clifford, Kyle Sturm, and Nick Theed of Ball Janik, and Clinton Tapper of Taylor & Tapper. As a coverage attorney, most of my clients are small businesses, small and local businesses here in Oregon, from all over the state, from the Portland metro area to Prineville to Medford. Most of them have been sued in a suit, and they are defendant, and they need to be protected, and they come to us because they're having trouble getting that protection from their insurance company. And so I'd like to focus most of my time on the duty to defend, because that's really the issue that hits closest to home for my clients. As Senator Shields described, what's going on, the problem is that there is no incentive really under current Oregon law for an insurance company to accept the defense if they don't want to. I'm not saying that they never accept the defense, but when they don't want to, for whatever reason, there is very little recourse other than to go out and hire a coverage attorney, which can be $20,000 to $50,000, to take them to court and force them to get the defense coverage that they're owed under the policy. Not only is that money at a time when a small business is in crisis already, and for those, you know, who are familiar with small businesses, most of them don't have a lot of reserves. Most small businesses are about one lawsuit from going under. So this is a time of crisis for them. Not only is that the money they have to shell out to go do that, but it's also delay. By the time they get that insured defense, it's a reimbursement after the fact. It's not a real-time defense. And that creates an enormous burden, and it's a completely different kind of benefit. It is not the same as a real-time defense with an insurance company providing you fiduciary duties in the course of that defense. So that creates a dynamic where a small business that had paid a premium to be protected in that scenario now has to fight a two-front war all by themselves. That is an enormous burden for small businesses in Oregon that face this dynamic. And I just want to provide some examples that I've encountered in my practice of where this comes up. I would say one area where it is extremely common is in the additional insured context. And in my work, that's usually where a subcontractor is required to have a general contractor named as an additional insured on that subcontractor's policy. And if later the general contractor is sued for, let's say, construction defects that involve the sub's work, that general contractor will tender the lawsuit to the sub's carrier and will say, I'm an additional insured under your policy, please defend me. Most of the time, those additional insured carriers will deny in Oregon. In my personal experience, it is the exception and not the norm to get that kind of additional insured defense coverage real time. Another example, I had a client come to me after he'd already settled because he was denied a duty to defend. This was a contractor, again, who was hired to create a landfill. And because he was denied the defense, he did a business decision or undertook a business decision that involved comparing what it would cost to defend this and fight this battle, even if he won, versus just paying to settle the case. And I can tell you he thought absolutely that this case had no merit. But from a business perspective, it made more sense for him to settle than to fight. And that's the kind of position that these small businesses are put in when their insurance companies don't accept the defense. I recently had an example of a maintenance company that was sued. Their insurance company said no. But when I read the letter, the no was based mostly on mischaracterizations of the allegations in the complaint against that maintenance company. And when I wrote back and explained that, I got more of the same back. And it became very clear that this was a reverse-engineered analysis designed to get to a denial, because why not? This carrier, for whatever reason, didn't want to be in this case, and it required me filing an immediate coverage action, preparing a summary judgment motion quickly, and hounding that coverage lawyer for that insurance company for 2 weeks on conferral for that motion before I got their attention. It was about $20,000+ to get that insurance company's attention. Insured shouldn't have to go through that to get a defense that is owed under the policy. And that comes back to all we're trying to do here is get the coverage that's owed under the policy. This isn't about covering claims that aren't covered, getting coverage for something that isn't covered. It's about getting coverage that is owed under the policy. And if a carrier is going to deny, it needs to be a thoughtful denial, a denial that they're really intending to stand behind, that they really believe in. It shouldn't be because, for whatever reason, they don't want to be in this case. So the remedy that this bill contemplates is not extra contractual, which means it's not going to expose the carrier beyond the policy limits. It's not a treble damages statute. It's not a bad faith statute. It's really about, did the carrier breach the duty to defend? Did they wrongfully deny that duty to defend? And if they did, they have to pay the claim up to the policy limits. Those are the policy limits that they accepted a premium for. So, you know, compared to other types of protections that are out there for insureds, this is actually a very measured protection. Some of the other issues that are addressed in Senate Bill 1590, I'd like to just run through real quickly. One of the other issues is independent counsel, and I think there's been some confusion over what that's supposed to do. Currently, when an insurance company accepts the defense, they provide a defense lawyer. And Oregon law considers that defense lawyer to have two clients, the insurance company and the insured. And that leaves some insureds, some small businesses, worried and concerned and in doubt about whether that defense lawyer really has their interests in mind, because this defense lawyer usually has worked with that insurance company from case to case to case to case, is being paid by that insurance company, and their next case is probably going to come from that insurance company, whereas the small business insured is not paying the defense lawyer, and they may never see him again. And so this is more of a practical, on-the-ground concern that insureds, when they are assigned a defense lawyer, they should feel confident that that defense lawyer is there to protect them, and they shouldn't have to feel like they can't trust that defense lawyer. So, you know, to some extent, this is a matter of perception, and there may be some disagreement as to whether it's necessary, but I can tell you that that perception, that doubt is absolutely out there, and it is real for some insureds. Another issue is the assignment of insurance claims. This is an amendment to ORS 31825. This already exists. This is a dynamic or a type of settlement that is already allowed by statute. It allows, when a judgment has been entered against an insured, it allows that insured to assign the insurance claim to the plaintiff in exchange for protection from collection on that judgment. So you can basically, as a defendant, if there's a judgment entered against you, you can take yourself out of the middle and let the plaintiff go directly against the insurance company. That's already allowed by 31825. But some insurance companies say that the anti-assignment provisions in their insurance policy prohibit that and trump it. And the problem is that all insurance policies have anti-assignment provisions. That is a standard provision. So if they're right, this statute doesn't do very much for Oregon insureds, and all we're trying to do is plug that perceived loophole so that there can be no question that ORS 31825 operates as intended. Another issue is transparency, and this has to do with the insurance division's regulatory complaint process. We are just trying to make that more public. There's no reason for that to be secretive. Obviously, private information can be redacted. That's not an issue. The issue is trying to bring light to some of the conduct that is out there. Not only will that allow small businesses to vet their insurance options, but it will also create an inherent disincentive for those practices to begin with, which I think is a very powerful tool. Regulatory estoppel is another issue that's been discussed, and this is just a basic common sense principle. If an insurance company says one thing to regulators, they shouldn't be able to now say something else when it comes time to pay the claim. It's not about what the regulators say or do or accept or rely on. It's not about changing the way courts interpret the insurance policy at all. It is just about what insurance companies get to say about what they meant. That's the focus of that provision. And lastly, the tractor fix is intended to plug a gap, an unintended gap in the UM-UIM statute, that if you're a farmer and you're driving on a public road from plot to plot and you get rear-ended by an uninsured driver, you should get your UM-UIM coverage. If that same farmer were walking on the road and was hit, they would get that coverage under their auto policy, and we would like to see that extended to if they're just driving on their tractor, which is something that auto policies won't insure. So there's no other way to get that other than to plug this gap.
Yeah, I'm starting to run out of time, and I've got a lot of people.
Yes, I appreciate
want to talk,
that.
So. Mr. Shaver?
Or Mr. Rich?
Yeah, hello there.
Or, excuse me, I did that wrong.
Mr.
Yeah.
You bet.
Got your name confused with the company.
There you go. Are you ready for me there?
We're ready. Go ahead.
You bet. Well, I'm Rob Rich with Shaver Transportation Company. We're a 136-year-old, fifth-generation, family-owned tug and barge line here in Oregon. We're on the banks of the Willamette River here. We have about 100 employees. It's been very interesting to get to listen to the last speaker so succinctly speak of the intricacies of issue involved with insurance coverages and how they affect small companies. My testimony today will be relatively brief. I just wanted to share from the perspective of the small business our support in a couple of areas and the difficulty that we face. As a tug and barge line, I could speak the rest of the afternoon about tug and barge operations and how the river works and all that stuff, and that's because we're experts in that area. That's what we do. when it comes to our upwards of a dozen insurance coverages that we carry here at Shaver, for our employees, for our vehicles, for our equipment, for our tugs, for a variety of businesses, business exposures, environmental and otherwise, and stop loss insurances and such. There's a myriad of insurances that a small business carries to protect itself. Getting back to my first comment about we know a lot about, a little tongue in cheek there, but we know a lot about the towboat industry. We really don't know a lot about the trap doors and the ins and outs of the insurance industry, particularly when it comes to large claims and specifically duty to defend and the independent counsel issue. We have firsthand knowledge of how important it is to support encouraging insurance companies to fulfill their duties to defend us with the policies that we have by imposing coverage by estoppel on those companies who wrongfully refuse to provide a defense. We shouldn't be in a position to not only be arguing, let alone having to retain counsel and fight a major carrier to provide coverage when we have bought and paid for the coverage. The coverage is clear, and they just happen to have a disagreement as to how it's going to be determined whether we're covered or not. Again, it gets back to that kind of simple question of we need rules in effect. And, you know, we're not a big rules company. We're not a big rules industry. That's not something we go after. But in this area where we're kind of a turtle on our back when it comes to dealing with large insurance companies with significant claims, specifically in the area of our experience, which has, you know, been in the environmental exposure here on the Willamette River, having a little more of a stick to be able to get the carriers to respond is a huge help to small business. I mean, we're not a tiny business. It's not like we're a dozen employees, but we still consider ourselves a small business from the standpoint that these kind of issues have a major, major effect on us. We support requiring insurance companies to provide that independent counsel in situations where the companies are providing this defense under reservation of rights. We have an independent counsel that has served us in our environmental claims, and it has helped us very much, but it has also cost us an enormous amount of money to have to do that as well. So if it could be required in the first place, it kind of lets the insurance companies know that, you know, if they're not playing fair, if they're not doing what they really need to be doing for the insured, then they're going to be subject to this. And there is a value in having bumpers, guards, however you want to look at the analogy, in this process for small business. And the last point I'd like to make, it was brought out in discussing this with our environmental attorney that gave me the opportunity to share with you folks. This is completely voluntary on my part. I really appreciate the opportunity just to get to do it. And that is that the different types of policies with different sizes of companies are treated differently under some aspects of Oregon law. I'm not fluent in that area, so I could have some error in what I just said. But in reviewing some of the information shared with me, I was very surprised that there was some uneven protections for policyholders with their insurers, and it only makes sense to have a more even protection throughout the industry in that area. So I hope my comments are of service, and if you have any questions, I look forward to them.
Any questions for this witness, this testimony? Okay, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you very much for allowing this to be shared like this today. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Rich.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Kelsey Wood and Lana Butterfield.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lana Butterfield. I'm here representing the Professional Insurance Agents of Oregon, and I'm here simply to introduce Kelsey Wood, who has come from Roseburg, and he will give our main testimony.
Mr. Wood, go ahead and you drove a long ways, and we wanted to make sure we got you in. So.
Good afternoon, and I appreciate the opportunity for my testimony, Vice Chair Garrod and members of the committee. Kelsey Wood, President, Senior Agent for Gordon Wood Insurance, been in the insurance industry for 33 years. I've seen a few changes in the marketplace, some legislative changes, some changes due to law changes. As mentioned, one of my concerns, my concern today is very much like one of the states, Montana, that if the conditions in this state are such that insurers are less able to predict future claims, thus appropriate premiums in their insurance contracts, they'll simply exit Oregon, leaving the state having to obtain insurance through surplus lines, excess or surplus, or non-admitted carriers. An example of what happened that created that situation was in the late 90s, turn of the last decade, with a construction defect. At one point in time, my insurance agency insured a lot of contractors with very inexpensive, great insurance policies from insurance companies directly regulated by the state of Oregon, directly admitted insurance companies I have an appointment and relationship with, really efficient policies that provided great coverage for a low cost of $500-$800 a year. Well, those times ended quickly with the phase-in of construction defect claims against those contractors and their insurers, where insurance companies en masse left the market to provide that coverage, leaving my agency with the only ability to get them insurance coverage through excess surplus lines or not admitted carriers. I'll review a little table as what the pros and cons of that kind of market like Montana has because of laws like these. For example, admitted carriers very typically have rather broad and commonplace, well-tested contractual provisions. The Insurance Service Officer, ISO, and the AIA provide very common, normal policy contracts us agents and the consumers and the legal industry are very familiar with. Whereas if we shift to a non-standard or a surplus lines or non-admitted carrier system like Montana, we'll find very few ISO or AIA-based policies, much more custom-written policies, policies issued, for example, by the Lloyd's of London. Another difference between admitted carriers versus surplus lines or non-admitted is policy rate making and supervision and competitive rates. If all of a sudden we go from 2,500 insurers directly participating in the Oregon market to an unknown less number through a non-admitted surplus agent market, we're going to have less competition, probably higher rates, and less competitive coverage, probably more restrictive coverage. And on top of that, most of the independent agents access the ability to get through non-admitted carriers through brokers. Brokers charge fees, usually $250. So at least the policy, the premiums will increase $250. Another difference is that directly regulated insurers are subject to the Oregon Guarantee Association should there be a bankruptcy or a problem like that. For non-admitted carriers, they're not subject to that. The clients will have to go back to that home state and act like a regular debtor. On agents' authority and efficiency, right now with direct carriers, we have a long-term relationship. I've been appointed and doing business with my insurance companies as many as 33 years. We have a real efficient relationship with those insurers. We can issue binders and certificates and endorsements and coverage almost immediately in many cases. Whereas if I'm relegated to the surplus lines market, I have to go through a broker. I have no authority. I can't issue certificates. I can't issue binders. I can't issue coverage. And that stuff will take some time to happen. One other recent development is in the five-star court system, court case. agents representing surplus lines carriers through brokers are now in this unknown circumstance where we may be representing our own coverage instead of be a representative. It's clearly in the statutes, the Oregon revised statutes, that we're supposed to represent the insurance company. Now this five-star case makes this question, is actually states that we're representing our own coverage. And as an insurance agent, if I'm hung out there to, when I sell a policy to a surplus lines company, I'm responsible for having issued that coverage, whether it's good coverage or bad coverage, exclusions or not, I may not do that. So there's some significant restrictions that could happen if there's a market change because of the desirability for insurance companies to do business in the state. And one more point. If this bill passes, they're actually taking the rights of some insureds away. For example, a local nonprofit in my community, a drug and alcohol counseling center, has a director's and officer's policy that gives them the right to carry their own defense up to a certain limit. And they want that. They have their relationship with their own legal representative. They don't want some unknown insurance company's lawyer representing them directly, yet their insurance policy covers that, pays for them that. You can take that away. Also, in professional liability circumstances, when a doctor or a professional's reputation is at stake, you know, they oftentimes don't want the insurer to settle, which oftentimes is a lower cost result. We can settle for $5,000 instead of spend $20,000, $40,000, $80,000 on defense. Let's just settle. A lot of professionals like, no, my reputation's at stake. They have a consent to settle clause. That's a right they have to be able to buy. That's a choice they have now. I believe this law will take that away. Those reasons are the reasons why I oppose this bill.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you. I've got two more people, and I got about 10 minutes.
Thank you.
So I'm going to call you up together. David Rossmiller and Brian Williams. I can push it a little bit, but I'm going to, supposed to lose the room at 10 till. So.
Chairman Beyer and Vice Chair Girard, I'm David Rossmiller. You heard me testify on Monday. I'm a partner at the Betts, Met, Patterson & Mines firm. I'm here representing the American Insurance Association and the Property Casualty Insurers of America. I don't need to go over the ground that you heard us go over on Monday, but there are some things that were just said that are just not correct. I think Senator Shields is getting some incorrect information. To go back to one thing that he said on Monday, let's talk about this business about what is Oregon an outlier one way, the other now, or is it going to be in the future? He talked about on Monday, Senator Shields, he said the American Law Institute had a draft, what he called model rules or legislation, and that's what his bill is patterned after. There is no such the American Law Institute. I saw a letter from the representative to the American Law Institute that confirms that the majority rule in the country is the one that Oregon has. Oregon is not an outlier with extremely reactionary type insurance law. The rules that Oregon has for the duty to defend and for insurance law are the majority rules in this country. What we see in Washington, that is an outlier. Now, I'm saying, and it's true, it's just one person saying this, but I'm offering you some good reasons, I hope, to believe what I say based on the testimony that I gave before and what I'm going to say today, that these changes are borrowed from other states, and each in their own way, those changes make Oregon an outlier beyond those states. So we've taken some extreme measures from other states, cobbled them together, only they're worse than what they have. So talking again, Senator Shields said, I looked at the charts that he submitted for evidence, pie charts. If you notice, one important thing when you're considering something like this is what's the data? Where's the data? There's very small data sets in that information. They're just pie charts without any numbers to go along with them. They're just a few years. Okay, I would encourage you to look at those deeper. Here we have a short session. This is a major policy change. with very short data. It's a very dangerous thing that's being put in here for a problem. You know, so as I was reading the bill for the 15th time this morning and listening to the testimony today, one thing that came to mind to me was this definition I've heard of a theologian. Somebody who answers questions that no one is asking. And we have to be careful as lawyers and legislators not to do the same. Here we're talking about addressing problems based on anecdotes and very little actual data, which would accomplish major changes that would drastically revise Oregon law and affect the way the courts analyze and have been able to handle these things. Just a couple points that I know that we're pressed for time, so I just want to go over a couple points that were mentioned this afternoon. No incentive to provide a defense is what I heard. That's not true. Oregon, since 1912, is one of the first states in the country that had a law that if you have to go after your insurance company, you can get all your attorney's fees back, as well as all the fees that you had to pay for your lawyers or what other damages that you incurred. So Oregon has had that. It was one of the first in the nation, has had that law and still has it. It's ORS 742.061. There are also other incentives that are inside companies to provide defense. You don't want to lose a lawsuit like that as an adjuster. You don't want to have a bad denial. They roundtable this stuff inside companies. You can lose your job that way if you have bad denials. If you fail to set reserves on a case, regulators can crack down on insurance companies that do that. So there's powerful incentives that are economic incentives. The most vital incentive of all to the people who are making those decisions, which is they want to keep their jobs. Nobody in an insurance company gets promoted or gets a bonus for unjust denials. It's just not the way it works. It just is not the way it works. If anything, I see, and I have represented, this is all I've done in my career, is work in the insurance coverage field. If anything, I believe that insurance companies bend over more to give coverage and defense more than they need to. Does it mean that happens every single time, that there's never a mistake? No, it doesn't. But you know what this bill doesn't do? It doesn't make any provision for an honest mistake, or somebody getting it wrong and then seeing the light. Because what this bill says, if you breach the duty, right there you are stopped from even participating in the case. Then the people can settle the case for any amount of money, and you have to pay it. That is, as I've just mentioned, the American Law Institute, I saw the letter from them this morning. They confirm that remedy, which is called estoppel, that is a minority opinion rule in this country. The one that Oregon has is the one that most states have. So let me just see if there's one other. Oh, going back to I know.
Your colleague at the bench wants to speak.
We're going to have an arm wrestle.
I'll let him go.
All right. Thank you, Senator Beyer. My name is Brian Williams and the rest of the committee. I'm an Oregon lawyer. I'm also a Washington lawyer. I've got an office in Portland. I practice primarily insurance defense. I practice throughout the state of Oregon and throughout the state of Washington, so I'm familiar with how both systems work. While I do some insurance coverage, primarily I'm defending people who have been sued. I represent a lot of trucking companies, I represent Les Schwab, I represent Albertsons and Safeway. I try a lot of cases, so I'm actually in the trenches on this. I'm also on the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel board. The Oregon Association of Defense Counsel is 700 lawyers. It, as an entity, does not come down to Oregon legislature very often. We do not take positions on most legislation. We reserve comment as an entity to situations where we think there is a problem procedurally or substantively that's going to cause an access to justice problem or really just wreak havoc with our tort system. This has several of those concerns. What I would say, first of all, is the suggestion that this is about a duty to defend issue really narrows down what this legislation accomplishes to a disingenuous level. It talks about any time a claim has the potential to exceed liability policy limits, that there's an obligation to provide independent counsel that represents only the insured. Okay. Every day I work on cases where there are claims in excess of policy limits. Every Oregon lawyer that does the kind of work I do does. We're talking about a huge number of cases. This is not a small correction. There are dozens of Oregon ethics opinions that govern my relationship with my clients. Talking about the Oregon tripartite relationship, I represent both the insurer and the insured. The insurer is paying my bill. The insurer is the one who's going to fund the settlement. I ought to be able to communicate with them. That's the Oregon approach. I don't think there's a problem with that myself. But changing that to we represent the insured only, which is the Washington approach, and I operate under both systems, it's a huge change. And for a short session that hasn't been really thought through and vetted properly, and when Senator Shields said he reached out to people in the industry, I don't know that he talked to a single member of the OADC. He certainly didn't talk to us at an entity level. We weren't aware of this legislation until very, very recently. The other issue is just how does this play out as a practical matter? And if I were a legislator, one of the things I would be concerned about is unintended consequences, things that play out differently than I envisioned. Okay, let me tell you how this works in Washington in the trenches as a practical matter. In Washington, when I'm defending a case, I frequently get a letter from the lawyer on the other side saying, hey, we'd like to propose a lawyer to your insured, your client, or we'd like to hire a lawyer for your client so that we can talk with your client's other lawyer about settlement. They then get together and cut a collusive deal, basically, where the insured is relieved of any responsibility, which is in the insured's best interest, obviously, but in the process agrees to an outrageous settlement. And you think, well, what would be the point of that if the insured isn't going to have to pay anything? Well, the insurer has to pay it. It's a collusive deal that results in astronomical settlements for way more than what the claim is actually worth, and it happens on a regular basis, which is why the state of Washington is regarded by people in my line of work as a judicial hellhole, similar to Montana. It's a place where insurance companies basically don't get treated fairly. Now, I am not here as an OADC board member to carry the water or the baggage for the insurance industry. We're not here for that. But I do personally view this as something that treats a business unfairly. I have a lot of concerns about that. This addresses a problem that, to my knowledge, does not really exist. What I would tell other people is that on a personal level, I can tell you I've recommended Mike Farnell's office to other people, to my clients who may need to file a lawsuit against their insurer because of coverage issues. When you buy a policy, it doesn't cover you under for everything that might happen. If you're a contractor and you put in a window badly, your policy of insurance doesn't cover that. If you burn a house down or fall off a ladder, it probably does cover that. So there are legitimate good faith issues that come up between insurance companies and insureds. And the pressure is on the insurance company to guess right on that dispute. Because if they don't and they get sued, they have to pay not only their defense lawyer and not only the underlying settlement, but also the attorney's fees of the insured that had to sue them for it. So at least in my experience and with the companies I personally work for, I can tell you that insurers really do try to get the decision correct on coverage and frequently hire independent outside counsel, pay thousands of dollars to get opinions to figure out whether they're making the right decision or not. So while this is presented as a question of the duty to defend, this is going to have a significant economic impact if it's passed. It will result in cases settling for a lot more money. It will result in a lot more lawsuits. And on another personal level, I would say that one of the privileges of being a member of the Oregon Bar is that we get along. It's collegial. We argue and fight in the courts all the time, but it's not nasty. Okay. The Washington system injects a level of gamesmanship where they're trying to set an insurer up on bad faith constantly that makes things nasty. Much less friendly, much less collegial. It's not the way business should be done, in my opinion. And I certainly hope the committee does not pass this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Is there any questions? I don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate you coming, and I'm way over my time. So we are going to close the public hearing, and we will carry this over to our next meeting. Okay. And that's it for today. Oh, this is one of those great he said, she said, what the hell, she said, what the hell. Oh, this is one of those great he said.